In his new book, Embattled River, The Hudson and Modern American Environmentalism, David Schuyler describes the efforts to reverse the pollution and bleak future of the Hudson River that became evident in the 1950s. Through his investigative narrative, Schuyler uncovers the critical role of this iconic American waterway in the emergence of modern environmentalism in the United States of America. Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York, is having an event tomorrow night at 6 p.m. featuring Schuyler, who will be joined in discussion by Paul Galay, who is president of Hudson River Keeper. David Schuyler is professor of humanities and American studies at Franklin and Marshall College and is the author of numerous books, including the award-winning Sanctified Landscape. Again, the name of the new book is Embattled River, the Hudson and Modern America Environmentalism. And it's a great pleasure to welcome David Schuyler to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm very pleased to speak with you, Joe.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for being here and for the very cool book. This is a story long in the making. What brought you eventually to it?
Well, I had been writing about the Hudson for a long time. I wrote a biography of Andrew Jackson Downing called Apostle of Taste, and in 2012 published Sanctified Landscape, Artists, Writers, Artists in the Hudson River Valley, 1820 to 1909. And in one of the reviews of Sanctified Landscape, Fran Dunwell, who's also a chronicler of the Hudson, really pointed the need for this as a kind of sequel.
When we look at Embattled River, when did the Hudson become an embattled river? We look at the 1950s. Is that really the start of it?
The Hudson became the battleground for environmentalism beginning in 1962, when Consolidated Edison proposed constructing a pump storage power plant at Storm King Mountain.
So at what point did the, but as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, the 1950s really, this became evident that there was not a great future for the Hudson in the sense of pollution. And that's when we started to hear not only this is what could happen, this is what is happening, and what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, it really starts in the early 60s, I think, because Stuart Udall, who was then U.S. Secretary of the Interior, visited New York and described the Hudson River as an open sewer. And that sent shockwaves or shock tremors throughout the Hudson Valley.
So how did that become? How did it become an open sewer? What went on? And give us a sense of the of just how much of a sewer it was in this time.
Well, you know, in New York City, for example, from the early 19th century onward, scavengers would basically clean out privies and just dump the stuff into the river. And as New York City grew in population and in industry, it started building a rudimentary sewage system in the 1850s, and that just dumped human waste directly into the river. And it accelerated over the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries.
And then, of course, there were the plants and commercial operations as well. How did they exacerbate the problem?
Well, they just simply dumped their industrial waste into the river in most cases. But it wasn't just industry. I mean, individual houses. I remember walking down the railroad tracks on the West Bank in Bonneville, New York, and the hilltop above was lined with these majestic late 19th century houses. And you smelled sewage all the way down at the river because they were just, you know, when people flushed their toilets, they were going directly into the river.
So at what point did the environmentalism begin? Scenic Hudson, of course, is leading the way, later joined by Riverkeeper and Clearwater and the Hudson River Valley Greenway and Hudson River Valley National Heritage Area, just to name a few. How were they led? What were the beginning of their efforts that ultimately brought them all together to fight this very big problem?
Well, Scenic Hudson organizes in November 1963, and that's really the first of the modern environmental organizations in the valley. Soon there were others, including the Hudson River Conservation Society, that went Aldrich-headed for a number of years. And really, the passage of the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts at the beginning of the 1970s was crucial, as was NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969.
So, we'll go ahead.
These acts gave the federal government and the states the power to regulate pollution. It was never fully enforced, and it was uneven at various times, but at least the potential use of those tools was there.
Why do you think they were successful? What was the ultimate because it was a long road, there's no question about it, but they were ultimately successful.
Yes, the Hudson is cleaner today than at any time, I would guess, since the mid-19th century. But, you know, you've got new challenges in the form of PCBs and micropollutants and chemicals that, you know, they're being disposed of legally, the chemicals, I mean, but sewage treatment plants were not designed to filter them out. So they pass right through the sewage treatment plants and into the river.
So there are still challenges, but let us, and I want to get to those challenges in a second, but let us focus on when it comes to the great work that has been done by these environmental groups. The subtitle of the book, The Hudson and Modern American Environmentalism. This environmentalism that we see that took place on the Hudson River, how has that been replicated across the country? How have we seen that reverberate across the country and help other rivers in similar situations?
Well, Riverkeeper is probably the best example of that from an organizational point of view, because Riverkeeper, there are now more than 330 riverkeepers and baykeepers throughout the United States and across the world. So that's an idea that really spread very quickly and very effectively. Scenic Hudson, in Scenic Hudson Preservation Conference versus the Federal Power Commission in 1965, the Superior Court in New York, I'm sorry, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled that Scenic Hudson had standing in the case, which opened up the federal judiciary to all kinds of environmental and other citizen lawsuits. It faulted the Federal Power Commission for not taking into account scenic, historical, and cultural significance, and it effectively mandated the first environmental impact statement. And those three pieces really become the heart of the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969.
So you talk about the environmental victories on the Hudson and the impact that they have. So let me just give the quick list, which is the New York State, the creation in 1970 of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, the national level, the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970, the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, the Superfund in 1980. These are that is very impactful. That says a lot about this movement.
Yes, it does.
When you think about that, and what is it, because there is something about the significance of the Hudson in and of itself, correct?
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Hudson really in the 19th century became sort of America's river. Travelers from across the United States and from Europe waxed poetic about the scenery, especially of the Hudson Highlands and the Catskills. And writers and artists really sanctified the landscape. The first really important American flourishing of the arts was the Hudson River School of Landscape Painting, beginning in the mid-1820s. And writers such as Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper and others also celebrated the river in ways that gave it significance to the nation as a whole.
And when you, so let us go back to the challenges that they face now, the challenges that are facing the river. We see the issues with the obviously with the Environmental Protection Agency. We still have a strong DEC, but at what point do we? I guess the point that you make in the book and the point that we should take home is that this is always a fight, right? I mean, this is always something to keep the river. You say it's cleaner now than it's been in generations. So keeping it that way is always a challenge.
Yeah, and the issues that are ongoing are PCBs, which, you know, the Hudson River, because of PCBs, is the largest Superfund site in the United States.
So where are we with that? I mean, we know where we are with that, but it's still an issue. There are no new PCBs that we know of entering the river, correct?
Well, there probably is still some seepage because the Hudson Falls plants, the GE plants, where most of the PCBs, virtually all the PCBs came from, were on rock that was pretty porous, and so that PCBs leaked into that rock, and it's probably still seeping into the river from that source.
When you think about again, the title of the book is "Embattled River." Are all rivers always embattled, or they don't have to be? Do they?
They don't have to be, but you know. What happened in the Hudson happened in almost every other river, in the sense that we outsourced our pollution to the river. And we did this across the United States. And it's not just an American problem either. You know, when Clearwater sailed down to Washington, D.C. for the first Earth Day, the crew were astonished to find that the Potomac was probably even more polluted than the Hudson was. And so what they thought was a local problem, all of a sudden they discovered was really a national problem.
Well, the name of the book is Embattled River, the Hudson and Modern American Environmentalism. David Schuyler is the author. He will be at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. for an event, a discussion, and a signing. You can find out more about that event by going to oblongbooks.com, oblongbooks.com. Again, the name of the book is Embattled River, the Hudson and Modern American Environmentalism. The book is published by Cornell University Press. David Schuyler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.